Chapter 31. The Spring Offensive. Donald Segretti and Jeb Stuart Magruder ordered their legions forth into the next battles. Wisconsin on April 4th, Pennsylvania April 25th, Indiana May 2nd, Oregon May 23rd, California June 6th. In Milwaukee, where every serious candidate was pushing hard in the state where David had felled Goliath in 1968, Muskie supporters stopped showing up for campaign events. Too often, the candidate arrived late or not at all. Deliverymen and limousines kept on arriving at the senator's hotel, claiming to have been summoned by George Mitchell, one of Muskie's close advisors. The staff would then waste precious time arguing with some poor schlub that they hadn't ordered several dozen flowers, 50 pizzas, or 2 limousines at the last minute. Then they'd waste more time arguing over which campaign was working to sabotage them. By then, the whole day would be shot. The Humphrey campaign had been able to undo a rat fuck at the last minute by getting a notice into the Saturday Milwaukee Sentinel saying there would be no free lunch that afternoon with the candidate and Lorne Green of Bonanza, as advertised in a flyer circulated in the ghetto. Rat fucking took money, and drained money away from throwing a proper National Party convention. The 1972 Republican meeting was to take place in San Diego, a nice, quiet, conservative Southern California city, nearby to the president's San Clemente retreat. But the city fathers had not cooperated, and the business community wasn't ponying up. So the White House approached an angel. The multinational conglomerate International Telephone and Telegraph had acquired 3 companies in 1969, in a deal bureaucrats in the Justice Department worried fell afoul of antitrust laws. Thus it was that in the middle of 1971, an ITT lobbyist named Dita Beard convened a Lollapalooza negotiating session whose principals included John Mitchell, Maurice Stans, John Ehrlichman, Chuck Colson, Bud Crow, and Vice President Agnew. The upshot? ITT promised $400,000 in donations to help stage the San Diego convention. Mitchell would protect the merger. The deal created more problems than it solved. As the Florida campaigning entered the home stretch, columnist Jack Anderson published a 1971 memo in which Dita Beard exclaimed to her boss that their noble commitment has gone a long way. The memo also included the observation, "Certainly the president has told Mitchell to see that things are worked out fairly." Its famous last words, "Please destroy this, huh?" Beard's boss didn't. The reference to the president and attorney general of the United States, now Richard Nixon's campaign manager, as direct parties to a bribe was a little more than embarrassing. So Howard Hunt was sent to cajole Beard into claiming she'd never written such a memo. "Who exactly do you represent?" Dita Beard's daughter asked of the red-headed stranger who appeared on her doorstep. "High Washington levels who are interested in your mother's welfare," he replied. Beard's public recantation clamped the lid on what Nixon feared was the biggest threat to his re-election so far. Convention plans were shifted to the island city of Miami Beach, same palm trees and ocean vistas, with the added advantage of placating the networks, which would be able to keep their equipment in place from the Democrats' convention in July. Still and all, through spring, the ITT lid threatened to blow. Which was why G. Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt brainstormed their own solution to the problem. Liddy no longer worked in the White House. Like Mitchell, and also former Commerce Secretary Maurice Stans, and former White House Assistant Jeb Stuart Magruder, Liddy had been promoted to a more important job, with the Committee to Re-elect the President, John Mitchell, chairman. Harry Dent had wanted Magruder's job, but Bob Haldeman thought him too much of a Boy Scout. He refused dirty tricks assignments. Magruder was the committee's deputy director, Stans its treasurer, Liddy general counsel. And what the general counsel suggested at a meeting with Hunt and a physician who once specialized in non-detectable accidents for the CIA was that Jack Anderson be assassinated. A car crash, perhaps, or a drugging. Or, Liddy suggested, Anderson could just become a fatal victim of the notorious Washington street crime rate. Their consultation completed, Liddy pulled out a $100 bill from Committee to Re-elect the President funds to pay the good doctor for his time. Liddy carried $100 bills everywhere for such purposes. He was something of a sink for campaign cash. When Mitchell was still running the Justice Department, Liddy met with Magruder and John Dean in the Attorney General's office. He came loaded down with easels and flip charts, like an advertising account executive pitching a campaign for a new national brand, and presented his plan to keep the Democrats out of the White House. It was called Gemstone, he explained. Operation Diamond would field a Nacht and Nebel sabotage team, night and fog, Liddy said, translating from the German. The men would have mafia experience, he explained, warning. Like top professionals everywhere, they don't come cheap. Ruby would tail the Democratic contenders. Cole would push Shirley Chisholm for the nomination. Emerald would eavesdrop on the Democrats' campaign planes and buses. Quartz intercept telephone traffic. Crystal float a barge off Miami Beach that would serve a double purpose, as electronic surveillance headquarters and a bordello to lure Democratic luminaries for blackmailable sex. Garnet was a plan for dirty hippies to stink up Democratic banquets. There were also operations Opal 1, Opal 2, Opal 3, Opal 4, and Topaz. He saved Operation Turquoise, Cuban commando teams slipping by night into the Miami Convention Center during the Democratic convention to sabotage the air conditioners, engulfing the hall in 110-degree heat, for last. John Mitchell smiled at that one. What he did not do was order the man who had just marched into the office of the Attorney General of the United States to outline a massive criminal conspiracy arrested on the spot. When Mitchell heard Liddy's proposed budget, $1 million, he just asked him to come back with a cheaper plan. And Gordon, burn those charts. Do it personally. Liddy got it down to a bare-bones $250,000, which would require untraceable cash. The campaign itself, the traditional part, would cost hardly anything. It would consist mostly of the president acting presidential. But the Republicans still had to pay for their convention. They still had to set up campaign committees and local organizations, pay for their ad buys and literature. Magruder and Segretti's rat-fucking operation soaked up a budget of $100,000. Running a campaign plane and a press plane for Agnew would cost $171,088 a month for rental, $35,000 for modifications, $683 per liftoff, $325 per hour in the air, 6 cents a mile per passenger for insurance, plus the 8% transportation tax. Saving civilization from the Democrats would be expensive. And you couldn't exactly, in the wake of ITT, do it by approaching respectable Republican businessmen and asking them to cough up checks to finance rat fucks and prostitutes. Which was where the man who had learned about business at a sausage casings factory in Chicago in the 1930s came in. Maurice Stans. Ethics in the sausage casings business were not very high, he would later write in his memoirs. Neither were they at the committee to re-elect the president. Shakedowns had previously been Herbert Kalmbach's job. In October of 1971, for example, the president's personal lawyer approached the chairman of American Airlines at a dinner and asked him to kick in $100,000. The chairman said he might be able to come up with $75,000. Kalmbach told him he couldn't be sure of the consequences with the Federal Aviation Administration should the full $100,000 not be forthcoming. And so it was. Such corporate contributions were illegal. Companies maintained slush funds to wash the money. But by the time Stans came on board, the old schemes were set to become obsolete. On January 19th, the House voted final passage of the Federal Elections Campaign Act, 334-19. It required the amounts of political contributions of more than $100 to be reported. Previously, only the contributor had to be listed. Nixon signed it with a flourish. By giving the American public full access to the facts of political financing, this legislation will guard against campaign abuses and will work to build public confidence in the integrity of the electoral process. He intended to follow its letter and pound its spirit into bloody submission. The law would go into effect on April 7th. A shakedown frenzy preceded that deadline. It worked, for instance, like this. Gulf Chemical sent $100,000 to the corporate account of a Mexican subsidiary, made out as a legal fee. A Mexican attorney then converted the money into 4 checks, payable to himself. He cashed them at the bank, then packed the bills into suitcases. It was flown in a plane belonging to Pennzoil and delivered to the office of Hugh Sloan, the committee to re-elect the president's accountant. A half-dozen pickup men wandered the nation over those 2 months. The take was an estimated $20 million. During one two-day period, $6 million passed through Hugh Sloan's hands. Hints of the backroom orgy seeped out to reporters. "Mr. President," one reporter asked at a March 24th afternoon press conference, "will you give us your views on the general proposition of large political contributions either by corporations or individuals in terms of possibly getting something back for it?" "Nobody gets anything back," Richard Nixon replied. "As a matter of fact, I think some of our major complaints have been that many of our business people have not received the consideration that perhaps they thought that an administration was supposed to be business-oriented would provide for it." Two reporters wondered in print why this obscure L.A. lawyer, Herb Kalmbach, had suddenly drawn so many of the nation's largest corporations to his once modest client list. The insolence sent the president over the edge. "They are out to defeat us," he rambled to Haldeman and Ziegler. "Both have spoken in the most vicious and derogatory terms of RN in the place where you really find out what these people think, the Georgetown cocktail parties. The evidence on this is absolutely conclusive. You do not need to ask me where I got it." The Godfather opened in April, another of those allegories infiltrating movie houses about the rot that hid behind supposedly honorable institutions. It was a gangster movie of a new sort, one that proposed that successful gangsters had loving families, and that loving families, if they were successful enough, acted like gangsters. Francis Ford Coppola's masterpiece encapsulated the sort of false front creepiness, "I believe in America," were the picture's first words, liberals had noticed in Richard Nixon since the 1950s. A button started appearing. "Nixon, Godfather in the White House." Sweet, gentle George McGovern made himself a vanguardist for campaign finance reform. His political director, Frank Mankiewicz, announced they would get their contributions on record 5 weeks before the deadline and called on all other candidates to pledge the same. As Wisconsin heated up, McGovern pointed out that only Nixon, Jackson, and Lindsay hadn't done so. "Muskie has been working on getting endorsements from the top down," McGovern said. "I have been getting them from the bottom up." Of John Lindsay, he said, "a handful of corporate leaders were bankrolling his campaign." Explained a campaign aide, "It's the populism of the prairies against the populism of Park Avenue." McGovern's ability to raise clean money was to be one of his drawing cards. The thousands of small donations he was getting proof of his appeal at the grassroots, his long-shot bid's fetish phrase. His grassroots financing was indeed impressive. A young civil rights lawyer and son of an Alabama dirt farmer named Morris Dees had fallen in love with McGovern after hearing him speak in 1970. Dees was a millionaire in the relatively new business of direct mail. He'd been an innovator in the field since college, when he began a business to deliver cakes to kids on their birthdays, exploiting a list he had procured of University of Alabama parents as his secret weapon. The lists were everything in the direct mail business. He saw no reason political fundraising should be different. George McGovern didn't need convincing. In his 1968 Senate race, he had tried and failed to hire the king of political direct mail, conservative Richard Viguerie. Dees's first letter from McGovern early in 1971 got an astonishing 15% response rate. Next, he signed up 3,000 members for a McGovern presidential club, each of whom pledged monthly contributions. The default rate was a mere 7%. "Gut mail," a staffer called their appeals. Nothing canned, that was what George McGovern was selling. It was why he announced his candidacy in the first month of 1971, and in Sioux Falls instead of Washington. Leave it to the old polls to make their ritualistic disavowals of candidacy until the most strategically opportune moment. Muskie had been losing in part because he was so mumble-mouthed. McGovern would win by being forthright. His conviction that an untapped majority existed for a plain-speaking ideological honesty started reminding observers of Barry Goldwater. "I will not change my beliefs to win votes," the conservative had said in announcing his own candidacy in 1964. In Phoenix, instead of in Washington. "I will offer a choice, not an echo." McGovern said much the same. That wasn't the only thing that reminded people of Goldwater. Like him, McGovern didn't behave like a candidate who wanted to win. Others avoided the thorny issue of amnesty for draft dodgers. McGovern sallied forth at Keene State College in New Hampshire and said the evils of the war itself had already vindicated them. Eleanor McGovern, pointing out that only 20% of the country agreed, pleaded with her husband to make amnesty contingent on performing alternative service. He stuck to his guns. Sticking to his guns was what he was running on. In Florida, he came out for busing as one of the prices we are paying for a century of segregation and housing patterns, and against the space shuttle program, Central Florida's great hope for economic recovery. He toured Chicago without the blessing of Mayor Daley, an unheard-of slight, and then, at the state capitol in Springfield, announced that his delegate slates for the March 21st Illinois primary had to be scrapped and reformed because they didn't meet the McGovern Commission's guidelines for gender balance. He was too good for his own good. But then maybe this was what it would take for Democrats to win in 1972. The Godfather was in the White House. The old ways no longer seemed to hold purchase. In January, DNC Chair O'Brien had put on a good old-fashioned $500-a-plate fundraising banquet to try to retire the party's debt from 1968. It felt like an old song for which everyone had forgotten the words. Humphrey didn't stay for dinner. McCarthy refused a chance at the podium. Ted Kennedy shifted in his seat as if he had wound up in the wrong room. Fred Dutton signed on with the McGovern campaign, along with his fellow RFK compatriot, Frank Mankiewicz. Maybe what Dutton told Scotty Reston was right. Maybe the emerging Democratic majority really was Nader populist at heart. Frontrunner Muskie was sounding more and more like McGovern, promising that Vietnam will remain an issue for me as long as a single human being dies, not for a cause, but for a mistake. In March, after McGovern's second-place shocker in New Hampshire, two surprising developments in the heart of the heartland helped convince prairie populists they were right. The first was in Lordstown, Ohio. A new General Motors plant had opened in the economically suffering region. To staff it, GM followed the new industry trend of hiring younger workers. They got sick less and used up fewer benefits, an important cost hedge against onrushing Japanese competition. Meanwhile, GM's new assembly division was radically reorganizing the production process for greater efficiency. The two developments collided in 1971, when Lordstown changed over models to Chevy's new import-style subcompact, the Vega. The line's old rate was 60 cars per hour. For Vegas, the rate was to be doubled. The old way was to compensate for such hardships with fatter wages and benefits. Steady work and pride in producing excellent machines had always been blandishment enough to compensate the Vega workers' depression-scarred parents for the monotony and alienation of factory work. But GM had not counted on the consequences of plunking a car factory full of kids down the street from Kent State. Working-class youth were starting to think like new leftists, identifying the meaning of life with a struggle for authenticity. Ford's labor relations chief described a new breed of union member, a younger, more impatient, less homogeneous, more racially assertive, and less manipulable member. Absenteeism and disciplinary citations doubled. Turnover almost tripled. Problem employees, the Ford expert said, almost habitually violate our plant rules. He worried about a general lowering of employees' frustration tolerance. The new left had a word for that. They called it alienation. The old-line UAW leadership pushed GM for more wages and benefits. The workers responded, in defiance of their union, by passing cars down the assembly line with parts missing. "Every day I come out of there, I feel ripped off," one young worker told a radical labor union researcher. "I don't even feel useful now. They could always find somebody stupider than me to do the job." The plant's various cultural factions, hillbillies, blacks, Puerto Ricans, hippies, united in February against a new get-tough policy against worker absenteeism. 97% voted to stop work. The Wall Street Journal monitored this unprecedented new quality-of-life strike obsessively, in almost the same terms as radicals. The generation just entering the workforce, the Journal worried in a March 15th editorial, "The Soul Must Panic," were lashing out at the monster of monotony. Politicians monitored the strike closely, too. Here was a new kind of political demand. The Lordstown strikers lost. The March 23rd settlement answered none of the anti-monotony demands. The heralds of the new politics took the message nonetheless. That greening of America values and the emerging coalition Dutton described, humanistic, critical of big business, big labor, and big government, were taking root in the heart of the heartland, amid the old politics' supposedly sturdy labor base. The second boost for prairie populist confidence unfolded in Pennsylvania's Susquehanna Valley. It had seemed obvious to radicals and new politics liberals what Richard Nixon's Justice Department was up to in the trial of the Harrisburg Seven. The proliferating gaggles of activists thrown in front of juries as conspirators, from the Harlem Four to the Fort Hood 43, were evidence of conspiracy itself, an organized campaign of repression against anyone who dared threaten the powers that be. "The people of this country will be watching this trial," a defense statement for the Harrisburg Seven roared, "to see if men and women who have cried out to the government, 'Thou shalt not kill,' will be put in jail for that." The conspiracy attitude was easy to mock. "Did you hear the one about the Indianapolis 500? They're innocent," the hippie replied. "Every last one of them." But this prosecution was obviously Kafkaesque. A nun who taught art history at a college in upstate New York and a pacifist priest were supposed to have plotted with fellow nuns and priests and a college professor to blow up Washington and to kidnap Henry Kissinger unless their demand for an end to the war was met. Overt Act number 23 in the indictment was that one of the nuns moved from Baltimore to Washington. Soon, the protest community was convinced they would all be in prison. The Village Voices reporter in Harrisburg, Paul Cowan, had already bought a house in Canada in preparation for the final crackdown. What he saw of the jury selection convinced him it would come soon enough. Mary McGrory of the Washington Post columnized that the defendants had already been condemned. "They have fetched up in a locality where moral passion is considered a social error, among citizens who have either decided they are guilty or who smugly declare they were too busy to read about the whole affair." The Justice Department agreed with the radicals. It would be a piece of cake to get a jury of terrified silent majoritarians to sentence riffraff like this to an eternity underneath the jail, whatever the weakness of their case. The proceedings took shape in February as doppelganger to Judge Hoffman's in Chicago. The hulking glass federal building and sterily modernist federal courtroom, the obsessively sequestered jury. This time they boarded up the windows of the jury bus. Some of the same radical lawyers, the same sort of tough-as-nails Roman Catholic prosecution team, the lead attorney had been plucked from the mafia beat. The defense once more welcomed the opportunity to conduct a political trial and get the issues before the American people. A hanging judge boasted of his contempt for the Fourth Amendment. "Speak for yourself. I have nothing to hide," he answered a defense lawyer who said government surveillance hurts all of us. Once again, the star witness was a police spy. Boyd Douglas was a fellow inmate of Philip Berrigan's at Lewisburg Penitentiary. He had been allowed into a study release program at nearby Bucknell University, which was how he helped Father Phil smuggle uncensored letters to Sister Elizabeth, from which they discovered Father Phil's reveries about whether the progress in ending the war would be hurt or hastened by kidnapping government officials, as radicals had in Quebec. But before Douglas could take the stand, his credibility as a witness was in tatters. The prosecution accidentally released to the defense a letter he'd written to the FBI, thanking them for money to buy a new car, and shaking them down for some more. "Considering what I will go through before and after the trial, or trials, I request a minimum reward of $50,000, tax-free. He also asked for a faked honorable discharge from the Army. It didn't do much for the prosecution's claim that their star witness was a strict Catholic and conscience-stricken former New Leftist. Editorials compared Boyd Douglas's $50,000 request to the Nixon White House's shakedown of ITT. Then Douglas took the witness stand. The letters he'd written to co-eds were read into the record. "I have given my life to the struggle," went one. "If I lose freedom and life to the movement, that's the way it has to be. I got warm vibrations from you." Then he invited her for a tryst. He had to admit, too, to lying to his handlers, holding back material that might further incriminate the priest to bargain for more money. On March 15th, the jury learned that an early FBI evaluation of Douglas judged him as having many of the attributes of a confidence man. It got worse. That same day, the key informant in the Camden 28 conspiracy case filed a pre-trial affidavit telling the story about how he had innocently approached the FBI in the hopes of foiling a draft board raid some of his friends were planning, and was then recruited by the FBI, trained in breaking and entering techniques, and instructed that under no circumstances was the raid to be suspended, because higher-ups, someone at the little White House in California, he was told, wanted it to actually happen. The next week, in Harrisburg, 2 weeks before the New Hampshire balloting, Boyd Douglas's FBI handler testified he had never known Douglas had been classified by a U.S. attorney as a menace to society. The government's case was unraveling. But the government's case against the Chicago Seven had been a shambles, too. And what difference had that made in preventing conviction? This defense decided to rest without dignifying the charges with a response. The seven defendants voted on that 4-3. "It demonstrates," one of them told the press, "we can never possibly be conspirators because we can never agree," which hadn't mattered in Chicago either. The jury withdrew to deliberate. The defendants steeled themselves for another silent majority jury nullification. An article appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times describing a defendant as an ex-rapist instead of an ex-priest. The mortified editor sent a letter of apology, acknowledging that one of the working-class printers in the press room might have introduced the error as an editorial comment. The jury deliberated a fifth day, then a sixth. One of the 12 kept pounding the table, invoking God's will, telling the story of another jury he had served on in which he had acceded to a not guilty verdict. Then God struck down the defendant with a heart attack a few days later. He demanded this bunch be jailed unanimously and immediately. On the seventh day, the jury returned a mistrial verdict. Paul Cowan of the Village Voice wrote of his shock, "At first, I attributed the verdict to the moral rectitude of the defendants, to the skills of their famous lawyers, to the sociologist's expertise. In other words, I believe that the specter of Main Street had been neutralized by the special skills of the urban elite." But later, Cowan did something remarkable. He interviewed the jurors. They said things like, "How stupid did those people in Washington think they were? They weren't," this radical realized, "so different from him. They bore frustration and rage that sat in their guts like rocks. They wished they had been able to retain the faith in the government they had brought to the trial, just as Cowan had earlier in the 1960s. Talking to them," he concluded, "I realized that for many Americans, democracy is a religion." He began to feel a bit of that old-time religion himself. "Sometimes it is possible to unify Americans," he realized, "in situations that call for generosity or fairness, instead of dividing them into battles over physical or psychological turf." The alienated radical sounded like the preacher's son McGovern. The lessons of Lordstown and Harrisburg seemed to suggest more and more Americans were uniting behind a new politics message. Central Pennsylvania and Central Ohio were just the kind of places McGovern was determined he could reach. He seemed to be proving it was possible that Main Street would vote for an anti-war liberal. The AFL-CIO revealed a poll it had taken in Wisconsin. McGovern was in the lead. It seemed a vindication not only of the new populism, but also of a year and a half's work. The McGovern campaign had begun just after the 1970 election. Gary Hart, McGovern's campaign manager, recruited a 24-year-old named Gene Picorni off a feed grain farm who'd been a legendary McCarthy organizer in Nebraska. By then, he was contemptuous of McCarthy for not having McGovern's hunger to win. Hart sent Picorni to Wisconsin to make their stand in the state that had driven Lyndon Johnson from office, the home to 1920s progressive hero Fighting Bob La Follette and tail gunner Joe McCarthy, two very different politicians whose commonality was a grassroots following contemptuous of the Washington establishment. Picorni was met, 17 months before the primary, with no little bafflement. But the jumpstart was key to Hart's national strategy. By locking up the left-wing activist base early, McGovern denied it to the other new politics aspirants. The sentimental candidate himself, in a memo to strategists, was excited for the early start for another reason: to have an opportunity to educate an entire nation and to learn from an entire nation over the period of the next 2 years. That is its own reward. McGovern wrote ingratiating letters to anonymous activists in 1971, as assiduously as Richard Nixon had written to newspaper publishers and J. Edgar Hoover in 1965. Flattered, they gladly advanced his visits, of which McGovern kept up a wall-to-wall schedule. The campaign always announced its events as receptions, not rallies, in case only a dozen showed up. While Nixon operatives were taking meetings with ITT lobbyists and hitting up executives for $100,000 checks, Hart had field men organizing rummage sales, petition drives, and workshops on how to canvass and set up storefronts. At McGovern's Washington headquarters, it was next to the liquor store in a neighborhood so dangerous cabbies wouldn't drive there, supporters worked through the night. Just like Nixon's plumbers, McGovern's students were convinced they were fighting to save civilization. Winning Wisconsin was the key. They would never be able to afford to organize so thoroughly again. At Picorni's insistence, McGovern had spent 72 hours in the Badger State at least once every 3 months, beginning early in 1971. Many towns had never before seen a presidential candidate, and even on the radio, they'd rarely heard one who could speak so authoritatively and sympathetically on agriculture. The fact is that over the past 20 years, livestock prices have remained the same, while the meat marketing margins have doubled, the editor of the scholarly volume Agricultural Thought in the 20th Century would say. The farmer's share of the consumer's food dollar has fallen from 47 cents in 1952 to 38 cents today. A squad of professionals arrived 2 weeks before the balloting, bivouacking in an out-of-the-way motor lodge in Milwaukee, inheriting volunteer organizations in every one of the state's 72 counties. 10,000 volunteers in Milwaukee alone. In the 4th District, the south side of Milwaukee, where the voters were Polish, just as Edmund Muskie was Polish, and had beaten civil rights marchers nearly to death in 1967, and had gone for Wallace in 68 and 64, McGovern volunteers from 20 states, as young as 13 years old, slept on the linoleum floor of a toy warehouse. Headquarters wouldn't waste bumper stickers on such inhospitable soil. The volunteers' canvas passed dark all the same, in a Milwaukee spring where the average daytime high was 34 degrees. Chetty White compared them to the forces of North Vietnam's General Giap, living off the land, tapping veins of frustration everywhere, raising money locally as they rolled, stirring to action hearts hitherto unstirred by politics. Timothy Krause in Rolling Stone invoked the guys who were in the hills with Castro. It wouldn't have worked if the peasantry and the proletariat weren't willing to be stirred. McGovern held a press conference in the home of a Polish family squeezed by property taxes that was featured in the New York Times. "You get more money, but it just don't do nothing," Richard Wysocki, a car mechanic, said, gesturing thankfully to his South Dakotan protector. McGovern started dropping in on bowling alleys on league nights. Word spread like wildfire, his earnest young traveling aide, Gordon Wild, recalled. It turned into a triumphal tour. McGovern's favor among blue-collar voters became the key to his campaign's strategy. George Wallace called a press conference the day after the Florida primary to announce he was coming to Milwaukee. He was armed with a poll showing he had just won 50% of the Democrats who had voted for Nixon in 1968 and one-third of Florida's new under-21 votes. "What has happened here in Florida just makes it more clear to me, and ought to make it clear to anybody with good sense, that I am a serious candidate for the nomination." McGovern welcomed the test. He called Wallace's Florida showing an angry cry from the guts of ordinary Americans against a system which doesn't give a damn about what's really bothering the people of this country today. "Busing," he said, "was merely a symbol of all these grievances rolled into one. Wallace, Nixon, Jackson, and Humphrey were using it to take people's minds off the problems which really concern them." The Wednesday before the election, the kind of late-season blizzard fell on southern Wisconsin that people printed up T-shirts to commemorate. Muskie was speaking, gutsily, in Kimberly, Wisconsin, a company town, for his proposal to ban the nation's biggest 200 companies from further expansion in size, Kimberly Clark was number 141, and was stranded. Jackson, shifting his appeal from busing to hitting Nixon for his elaborate machinery on wage controls, but virtually nothing on price controls, defending himself from charges his campaign was being financed illegally by Boeing executives' traveler's checks, got stuck in the sparsely inhabited North. Humphrey and Lindsay were socked in too, and it seemed as if a sign. Only McGovern plowed through to his next event. A POW's wife standing loyally by the candidate's side, he cried that the truth is that only by ending the war can we get our prisoners of war released, that Richard Nixon's continued bombing ensures that American prisoners will remain in their cells. The issue would become more pressing within days. South Vietnam had dodged a Tet season attack by keeping ARVN troops in their barracks until the end of the holiday. Strategists presumed the communists would save their final offensive for 1973, by which time many more U.S. troops would have been withdrawn. Instead, they staged a 1972 spring offensive. Some 120,000 North Vietnamese regular troops poured over the 17th parallel, accompanied by the communists' most intense rocket and artillery bombardment of the war. By the first day of April, the entire South Vietnamese 3rd Division was in retreat. The next day, one of its regiments stripped off their military insignia and joined the civilian refugees streaming south. The day after that, another regiment bartered for their lives by turning over their artillery cannons. Another spectacular failure for Vietnamization, exactly 1 month before American forces were scheduled to draw down to 69,000 troops. Richard Nixon half welcomed the news. It was, in a way, his Gulf of Tonkin incident, his excuse to move all in with a hellfire knockout punch he'd been dreaming about since planning Operation Duck Hook. The mission was christened Operation Freedom Train. The president ordered a fleet of B-52s to carpet bomb the demilitarized zone. But in Quang Tri, as in Wisconsin, foul weather clouded the skies. Air Force brass told the men not to fly. So Kissinger brought in a new Air Force general, named him Air Commander, and gave him a fourth star, bypassing Admiral Maurer. Nixon delivered a Patton-esque speech to Bob Haldeman and started bombing with savage intensity. The bombs started falling on primary day, which the Today Show observed with a half-hour live from Milwaukee. Jackson, Wallace, and Humphrey massed in anyone but McGovern chorus in favor of the bombing. The government should take whatever action is necessary to protect the remaining residual troops. Since Muskie didn't mention the matter in his segment, the president told Haldeman to get to work attacking him for showing no concern for the POWs or the protection for the 70,000 GIs. Bad weather favors insurgents. At 9:40, Frank Mankiewicz announced McGovern had taken 7 of Milwaukee's 9 congressional districts, including the 4th, where the residents had beaten the civil rights marchers in 1967, and the 5th, which an organizer described as Archie Bunker's Street drawn out to infinity. McGovern called his victory a vote of protest and hope. Reporters, having missed the story of McGovern's awesome organization, began typing phrases such as stunning victory, and noting that the third-place finisher, Humphrey, who had the full endorsement of the state AFL-CIO and was supposed to be so beloved in the Badger State that they called him Wisconsin's third senator, edged out Muskie, but that Muskie was edged out in turn by George Wallace. "Senator Muskie, are you finished?" a reporter asked. More or less, he was. Senator Henry Scoop Jackson tied for the booby prize with the matinee idol mayor of New York. Lindsay's press secretary lost $102, having bet his man would pull 10%. Lindsay only ended up with 7 and quit. George Wallace held strong in second place. The next day, McGovern people started laughing at the establishment that had been laughing at them. His janissaries made calls to incredulous reporters, claiming that despite his being in fourth place in national polls, despite his having earned only 95 of the 1,508 delegates required to win, McGovern had just about sewn it up, thanks to his strength among activists in caucus states. Time started planning a McGovern cover. Evans and Novak noted the emergence of an anybody-but-McGovern movement. Then, the day that Wisconsin helped clarify the confusing Democratic picture, the White House got to work on reclouding it. The PE wanted to be sure that we get people to follow up on the line, that Kennedy is now the obvious Democratic candidate, Haldeman wrote in his diary. He liked my idea of waiting a few days and then having Connally give Teddy Secret Service protection. The Secret Service were under Connally's Department of the Treasury, on the basis that there's general agreement that he's going to be the candidate. On April 6th, B-52 planes pushed 60 miles farther north, accompanied by headlines like, "A big new phase of war is opening." McGovern was now being called the stalking horse for Kennedy, as the Massachusetts senator gave his most lacerating anti-war speech to date. The simple truth is that this test of Vietnamization, with or without American support, is a wholly immoral and unjustifiable test, because it is a test that is being carried out with the lives of men, women, and children. Those dead and dying bodies stretched out beside the road across our television screens last night are the bodies of human beings. We do not have the right, no one has the right, to demand a test like that. $10, $20, $50 checks with angry notes attached about ending the slaughter started flooding McGovern headquarters. Nixon campaign headquarters, a block from the White House, was even more the maelstrom. The Federal Elections Campaign Act went into effect the next day, and the suitcases full of cash and negotiable securities were flying in a frenzy. Rosemary Wood scribbled out a makeshift list of all the money they were scrambling to process, to keep track of their chits. Later, that list was entered into evidence in a congressional investigation and earned the nickname Rosemary's Baby. The next big day for Democrats was April 25th, with primaries in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. On April 10th, the president sent the B-52s another 90 miles north. He also made a carefully coded diplomatic utterance at a signing ceremony for the Biological Weapons Convention. Every great power must follow the principle that it should not encourage directly or indirectly any other nation to use forms of armed aggression against one of its neighbors. Henry Kissinger was due in Moscow in 9 days to cement the details for a presidential visit, scheduled for the last week in May, for final talks and perhaps the signing of a strategic arms limitation treaty, under negotiation since November of 1969. Decoded, Nixon's message meant, "We've noticed that the North Vietnamese are fighting with better weapons, provided by you. Desist, or lose your summit, your treaty, and your chance to increase your influence with the United States, to balance out your rival China's influence with the United States. Desist, or the South Vietnamese government might fall before the U.S. presidential elections. Whenceforth, Richard Nixon would be very, very angry." But Russia hardly wanted to seem a pushover on the eve of a summit. The diplomatic task was complex. Domestic politics, too, were difficult to juggle. On April 12th, Nixon and Kissinger explained to the Republican congressional leadership why they were sending them into an election season while increasing the number of active B-52 bombers in the Vietnam theater from 45 to 130, ships from 22 to 40, and fighter bombers from 150 to 275. "What the enemy seeks," said their president, "is to inflict such a defeat on the ARVN that the government of South Vietnam would collapse and create so much turmoil in this country that we will collapse. Then they will go into negotiations. The enemy attacked now," the president said, "because they couldn't hold out for another year." Decoded, that meant, "I am about to finish the job, and those who object will have stabbed their country in the back." On April 16th, 5 behemoth B-52s pounded Hanoi and North Vietnam's lifeline port, Haiphong Harbor. Fighters strafed down below. Among the casualties were 4 Russian ships. Nonetheless, 3 days later, Kissinger proceeded to Moscow without Politburo objection. The summit was on. Richard Nixon had won the diplomatic battle. He still had a political test ahead, keeping his credibility with the public. He embarked on a series of photo ops, flying up to Ottawa, signing a Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement with Canada to mark the 3rd annual observance of Earth Day, meeting the table tennis team from the People's Republic of China, commending the District of Columbia's police for a decline in the crime rate, signing an executive order for a National Center for Housing Management. Then, the night of April 26th, he went on TV to make his latest Vietnam pitch. "Our draft calls now average fewer than 5,000 men per month. We have offered the most generous peace terms. The South Vietnamese are fighting courageously and well in their self-defense. 20,000 more American troops would come home by July 1st. We would return to Paris to negotiate, thanks to the effectiveness of the air and naval strikes. We are not trying to conquer North Vietnam or any other territory in the world. That is why I say to you tonight, let us bring our men home from Vietnam. Let us end the war in Vietnam. But let us end it in such a way that the younger brothers and the sons of the brave men who have fought in Vietnam will not have to fight again in some other Vietnam at some time in the future. My fellow Americans, let us therefore unite as a nation in a firm and wise policy of real peace. Not the peace of surrender, but peace with honor. Not just peace in our time, but peace for generations to come. Thank you, and good night. It marked a profound chasm between the public and private transcripts. The previous day, Henry Kissinger had outlined their next options: hitting power plants, docks, mining Haiphong Harbor, bombing civilians. "I think we ought to take the dikes out now," Nixon offered. "Will that drown people?" "That will drown about 200,000 people." "Oh, well, no, I'd rather use a nuclear bomb. Have you got that ready?" "That, I think, would be too much. The nuclear bomb, does that bother you? I just want to think big, Henry, for Christ's sake." Kissinger paused, taken aback. He collected himself, eventually responding with the one thing he knew would talk the president down from his flight of fantasy. "I think we're going to make it." Until election day, he probably meant. Saigon would hold on at least until then. Democrats voted in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. It was a split decision. The new politics took the Bay State. The old politics took the Keystone State. Massachusetts was more or less preordained. Massachusetts's plentiful anti-war Democrats had held a January caucus in which they agreed to unite behind a candidate who got more than 60%. McGovern, in the first public flexing of his organization's depth, did so comfortably. That he couldn't afford a campaign plane during the days of the New Hampshire primary had also helped. He would instead take commercial flights from Boston, campaigning there before boarding his campaign bus for Manchester, while endorsement Ed soared overhead at 30,000 feet. The tortoise won Massachusetts virtually unopposed. The next day, the hare, New England's own Edmund Muskie, finally dropped out of the presidential race. Pennsylvania was more interesting. Muskie, Wallace, and McGovern tied for second at about 21%. McGovern did reasonably well. The plurality, however, went to Hubert Horatio Humphrey. A story lay behind that. The Keystone State was where old line labor, whose former commanding influence in brokering Democratic presidential nominations had been eviscerated by the reformed nominating process, staged its revenge. The AFL-CIO's president, George Meany, was a dyed-in-the-wool war supporter. "If we don't fight them there, we're going to have to fight them in San Francisco," he'd said in 1965, before engineering a 2,000-6 vote against an anti-war resolution at a labor convention. Having surrendered their king-making role to ordinary primary voters, who were proving to be alarmingly amenable to the candidate of the anti-war hippies, old-line labor now made its move to take McGovern out. Its vehicle was old, reliable Hubert Humphrey. It had first been tried in Wisconsin. Badger State labor leaders told their memberships not to vote for McGovern because he hadn't voted to end a right-wing filibuster against an anti-labor right-to-work law in 1966. This was nasty politics. Actually, McGovern's labor voting record was just about flawless, better than John F. Kennedy's in 1960. So good, in fact, that he feared for his re-election in 1968 in a conservative state like South Dakota. Upon which, George Meany, like some labor pope, had granted McGovern an absolution to vote against right-to-work in 1966. In 1971, Meany had explicitly signed off on McGovern as an acceptable Democratic nominee. Now, in 1972, the pope ordered his Wisconsin bishops to use that vote to call McGovern a traitor to labor and turn out their machine for Humphrey. They had been no match for McGovern's Badger State Army. But McGovern had no army in Pennsylvania. He had spent all his forces in Wisconsin. But big labor always had an army at the ready. Pennsylvania was Humphrey's first primary win in three presidential campaigns. Muskie and Jackson had been rebuked by the voters. Evans and Novak were reporting that any chances Ted Kennedy would enter the race were done for good. That left anybody but McGovern with a name and a face. A smiling, exuberant face. Which was the soul of the divided Democrats' misfortune in the spring of 1972. Hubert Humphrey personified for New Politics voters the forces who'd stood by when kids were beat up in the streets of Chicago in 1968. At the University of Pennsylvania, he was heckled as America's number two war criminal. As he strolled down Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, a long-haired youth screamed in his face, "I don't see how you can smile when all those bombs are dropping on innocent civilians in Vietnam. You have no right to smile." The nomination had come down to this: the purest possible old politics versus new politics showdown, a Democratic civil war. The neatness of the Democrats' divisions was almost suspicious. The only logical explanation of the Democratic presidential campaign so far, Scotty Reston wrote in his New York Times column at the end of April, is that it must have been planned by the Republicans. Little did he know, his joke was literally true. The White House was delighted at George McGovern's ascendancy. He was the one serious contender they had never rat-fucked. They loved the combustion between the kind of people who loved Humphrey and the kind of people who liked McGovern. They themselves had helped set the fuse. The sudden surge in Senator Hubert Humphrey's prospects for another bout with Richard M. Nixon, Evans and Novak wrote in their April 27th column, the day after the Massachusetts and Pennsylvania primaries, is more the product of Senator George McGovern's spectacular landslide in Massachusetts. Despite his apparent success in the bowling alleys of Beertown, he'd only won 10% of the blue-collar wards in the Bay State. McGovern is now being taken with infinitely more seriousness, the columnizing duo wrote. Since Wisconsin, his eager and talented volunteers have flooded precinct conventions in such non-primary states as Kansas, Missouri, Vermont, and Idaho to ambush the regulars. And now those regulars fear McGovern as the Democratic Party's Barry Goldwater. They were ready now to fight back. For instance, by wielding not-for-attribution quotes like daggers in Evans and Novak columns. One liberal senator, whose voting record differs little from McGovern's, they wrote, feels McGovern's surging popularity depends on public ignorance of his acknowledged public positions. The people don't know McGovern is for amnesty, abortion, and legalization of pot, he told us. Once Middle America, Catholic Middle America in particular, finds this out, he's dead. The phraseology was repeated almost identically by Scotty Reston 3 days later. George McGovern has run an intelligent and determined campaign and has now got to the top of the greasy pole, but with a heavy load of promises: to slash the defense budget steeply, legalize pot and abortion, and grant amnesty to the Vietnam expatriates. Selling this to George Meany and the Labor Organization, which is about the only effective political organization the Democrats have, will not be easy, and it will not be very popular with many other Democratic candidates who think pot, abortion, and amnesty are explosively dangerous issues. The formulation was about one-half libel. Some prominent figures in American public life did indeed favor legalization of pot. They included William F. Buckley. But that wasn't McGovern's position. His agreed with the recommendation of the President's National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, decriminalization, or lessening penalties, because statutes that defined at least 20 million Americans as criminals created a crushing burden for law enforcement agencies. He favored prioritizing in its place $1.5 billion for treatment of addiction to drugs such as heroin, not far off from a program the Nixon administration actually initiated. Nixon hoped it would help them announce reduced crime rates in time for the presidential election. Legalize abortion? McGovern was actively hostile to it, to his feminist supporters' chagrin. "You can't just let anybody walk in and request an abortion," he told Time. Pat Nixon, in one of her rare press conferences, noted, "I really am not for abortion, on demand, wholesale," adding that this was a question for the individual states, not as a national issue, which was precisely McGovern's position. But the invention that McGovern was pushing abortion and drug legalization took hold. The story contained a certain poetic truth. not about the policy issue specifically, but about the nation's polarization. The Chicago 7 trial had been a microcosm of that polarization, and McGovern had pleaded with Mayor Daley to dismiss the case. It was something hard-headed observers grasped better than either McGovern strategists in their 20s or the middle-aged men that worshipped youth. That success built by locking up the left-wing youth activist base might bear seeds of future defeat. McGovernites had discounted the signs. Like the man on the south side of Milwaukee who, asked by the young canvasser what he thought of McGovern, said, "I'd vote for him if he turned Christian." Or the Milwaukeean who answered the same question, long before Evans and Novak's prompt. Perhaps he'd heard it from his union. "McGovern? He's for dope." He wasn't. But his canvassers were. 4 years earlier, young Eugene McCarthy workers bunked segregated by sex and voluntarily banned alcohol. That wouldn't fly now. "Jesus, we won the fucking city of Fond du Lac with 30 high school kids, three-fourths of whom are drug freaks," a Dartmouth grad proudly told Rolling Stone, whose political reporter, Hunter S. Thompson, was a proud drug freak too. On April 23rd, in a spontaneous act of love for his honesty and Vietnam stand, the Yippies endorsed George McGovern. Once they became convinced that Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin weren't out to sabotage McGovern and elect Humphrey in order to heighten the revolutionary contradictions, the McGovern team welcomed their help to register new under-21 voters. A 28-year-old McGovern strategist set up a meeting with Abby and Jerry in Washington. It fit their campaign theme. McGovern can unite the country from a steel worker in Gary, Indiana, to a Yippie in Boston. The campaign team was hoping to channel the anti-establishment energy they believed was driving voters to Wallace. They turned a blind eye to the Wallaceites who identified McGovernites with the establishment they were insurging against. They ignored the extent to which Evans and Novak were right, that if these voters got to know McGovern better, they might like him less. Like the fellow who eagerly shook the hand of George McGovern at the U.S. Envelope Factory in Massachusetts, he explained to a reporter, "We feel the colored element is just getting way too much welfare, and McGovern might just be tough enough to crack down." Instead, McGovernites pointed to Nixon's escalation of the bombing in the face of an obviously war-weary public. But Evans and Novak reported something else in that April 27th column, that according to White House pollster Albert Sindlinger, the number who wanted to go all out to win the war rose from 23.3% to 29.7% after the communists began their latest offensive, then another 2 points after Nixon started bombing. Those willing to admit defeat and give up hung steady at about 20%. Those agreeing President Nixon is doing all he can to settle the war, at a low of 46.8% after Cambodia, was now at 63.3%. "Is this Wallace country?" the MC cried in a field house in Indiana, which had its primary on the first Tuesday in May, along with Tennessee and Ohio. "Yes." "I can't hear you. Is this Wallace country?" "Yes." The MC introduced Billy Grammer and the Travelon Boys of the Grand Ole Opry. George Wallace's 11-year-old daughter was introduced, then his 30-year-old second wife. Then the man himself stepped behind his special bulletproof podium covered in red, white, and blue bunting. He sported more fashionable suits than in 1968, and more fashionable rhetoric. Nothing about shooting rioters through the head or running down protesters with limousines. The racism was only between the lines, such as in his proposals to make child abandonment a crime to decrease the welfare rolls, and to reconfirm Supreme Court justices every 6 to 8 years. His main appeal was tax relief to stimulate consumer spending and bring more employment, and a $1,200 tax credit for every working person and dependent. He said he was a populist, working for an America where the average men are the kings and the average women are the queens. He said that he had been all along, and now they are taking the same stand. What does that make them? It makes them copycats. Across the border, the chief copycat was Scoop Jackson, campaigning full-time in Ohio for one final desperate last stand. He didn't have a single elected delegate. The Washington Post featured him on May 1st as a curiosity who threw parties where no one showed up. He called himself a progressive Democrat and hit every burg with a military base, saying it would become a ghost town if George McGovern became president, scowlingly pointing out that the South Dakotan was supported by Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. His aides, who'd thought of him as a conciliatory figure, cringed in embarrassment. He defended himself to the Post. "I'm not trying to get into a McCarthy-type thing." But in 1948, why McGovern practically supported the Communist Party. He hammered the South Dakotan so hard, in fact, and with such futility for his own political fortunes, people wondered if Hubert Humphrey had put him up to it. The man who'd been offered 2 cabinet posts by Richard Nixon explicitly denied the charge. Then, the day before the Ohio primary, Jackson withdrew, renewing suspicions. In Vietnam, the ARVN was floundering. Back home, an annoyance cleared up for Richard Nixon. J. Edgar Hoover, the man who wished to claim all the power of intimidation in Washington for his very own, who began compiling his files on 500,000 subversives during the 1919 Red Scare, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation since its founding, who kept columnist Joseph Alsop on a string by retaining photographs of him in flagrante delicto with male KGB agents in Moscow, was dead. "Jesus Christ, that old cocksucker," was the president's private response. Publicly, Nixon arranged for Hoover's half-ton lead-lined coffin to lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda, as if he'd been a president, and said at his funeral, "The good J. Edgar Hoover has done will not die. The profound principles associated with his name will not fade away. Rather, I would predict that in the time ahead, those principles of respect for law, order, and justice will come to govern our nation more completely than ever before. Because the trend of permissiveness in this country, a trend which Edgar Hoover fought against all his life, a trend which was dangerously eroding our national heritage as a law-abiding people, is now being reversed." And, as if on cue, the president's men amped up their lawlessness. A squad of Cuban operatives, led by Bernard Barker, huddled near the Capitol steps where Daniel Ellsberg was among a group reading the names of dead servicemen. "Hippies, traitors and communists," Barker told his men, planned to perpetrate an outrage on Hoover. He pointed out Ellsberg. "Our mission is to hit him, to call him a traitor and punch him in the nose. Hit him and run." It was, like the Fielding burglary, a botched effort. His men started punching hippies at random and were chased off by the police. The committee to re-elect the president's head of security, a former FBI and CIA operative named James McCord, made a long-term reservation at a Howard Johnson's out past George Washington University by the Kennedy Center, a mile away from the committee's 1701 Pennsylvania Avenue office. The big story from the Tuesday primaries was Ohio. They were still counting votes. Humphrey edged out a win. McGovernites charged election fraud in the black precincts of Cleveland. "McGovern and Humphrey running even," the Times headlined. In the Post, David Broder pointed out that with George Wallace's wins in Tennessee and Indiana, Democratic sources said the Alabaman was on his way to enough delegates, perhaps 10%, to deny Humphrey or McGovern the nomination unless one of them agrees to bargain on Wallace's terms. The next contest was in South Dakota's neighbor, Nebraska, where Humphrey hadn't been bothering to campaign in the face of an expected McGovern romp. 3,000 McGovern volunteers were eager to confirm what seemed to them obvious, that McGovern appealed to conservative farm states. But then, all of a sudden, it was as if Scoop Jackson were speaking from beyond the political grave. McGovern rolled across the heavily Catholic Cornhusker state for a whistle-stop tour, following the same route as RFK in 1968. But everywhere he went, everyone just suddenly seemed to know that their neighbor George McGovern was a fan of abortion on demand. A group called Citizens Concerned for the Preservation of Life had taken out a half-page ad in The True Voice, the paper of the Omaha Diocese, quoting from Evans and Novak, "The people don't know McGovern is for amnesty, abortion, and legalization of pot." The panicked campaign distributed flyers at parish churches after Sunday Mass. The McGovern Record, on one side, rebutted the claim. A photo of the candidate with one of RFK's daughters and newspaper headlines such as "Ethel Kennedy Plans Picnic for McGovern" were on the other. The campaign pulled in a big gun. Charlie Guggenheim, the Kennedy family's favorite documentarian, who sat the senator down in front of 8 ordinary Nebraskans, including a nun, Roger Ailes style. McGovern told them and the cameras he deplored the last-minute smear campaign, favored no federal law on abortion, hit the scarecrows that have been trotted out in the closing days of this campaign by a political opposition that is cowardly and does not want to address the real issues, and assured Nebraska TV viewers he wouldn't legalize pot, though it ought to be treated as a misdemeanor, punishable by fines rather than jail sentences. It was the same answer Humphrey gave on pot when asked. Humphrey's position on abortion was identical to McGovern's, too. His position on amnesty was only slightly different. Humphrey favored it coupled with national service. The Washington Post patiently explained all this in a long article about the controversy. But the Washington Post wasn't much read in Nebraska, and it wasn't Humphrey who'd been placed on the defensive. There is a saying in politics: if you're explaining, you're losing. The Republican National Committee's monthly magazine, First Monday, catapulted the propaganda. While South Dakota Senator George McGovern may give the impression of being a mild-mannered milquetoast, he is in reality a dedicated radical extremist who, as president, would unilaterally disarm the United States of America and open the White House to riotous street mobs. On May 8th, amid this latest flurry of Democratic disarray, the president went on TV to sell another escalation in the air campaign. Connolly urged him, "Don't worry about killing civilians. Go ahead and kill them. People think you are now, so go ahead and give them some." "That's right," concurred the president. "There's pictures on the news of dead bodies every night," chimed in Haldeman. "A dead body is a dead body. Nobody knows whose bodies they are or who killed them." They codenamed it Operation Linebacker. The president did love his football. Its centerpiece was mining Haiphong Harbor, which was filled with Soviet ships. Not since 1962 had two nuclear powers seemed to have tangled so dangerously. Some feared it might end in mushroom clouds. Mining the port of Haiphong was the sort of gamble the Joint Chiefs of Staff were always proposing, and Lyndon Johnson was refusing, and not just for the nuclear risk. Johnson also refused the idea for its cruelty. Weapons arrived there, but also food, infrastructure needs, medical supplies. Ron Ziegler observed in Nixon that ruddy glow. Doing what Johnson refused to do made Nixon giddy. Still high from his speech, in the middle of the night he dictated a memo to Kissinger. "I cannot emphasize too strongly that I have determined that we should go for broke. Now that I have made this tough watershed decision, I intend to stop at nothing to bring the enemy to his knees. If the target is important enough, I will approve a plan that goes after it even if there is a risk of some civilian casualties. We have the power. The only question is whether we have the will to use that power. What distinguishes me from Johnson is that I have the will in spades." He had the confidence in the politics. George Wallace's line on Vietnam elucidated why it worked: "Get it over with. And if you can't get it over with, get out now." Wallace followed that utterance by placing the blame other than with the commander-in-chief and the people who voted for him. "We face a Vietnam Dunkirk," Wallace would say, "because these liberals listened to a bunch of people who jumped around in the street while you folks are working hard, paying taxes." It was one of his best applause lines. Americans hated the war. They hated the anti-warriors more. Nixon announced the harbor mining as a decisive military action to end the war. It wasn't decisive enough for the general counsel of the committee to re-elect the president. When General Alexander Haig of the NSC traveled to 1701 Pennsylvania Avenue to brief the campaign staff on the operation, G. Gordon Liddy responded, "General, why haven't we bombed the Red River dikes? If we did that, we'd drown half the country and starve the other half." On May 9th, the Senate Democratic Caucus condemned the move 29-14. Endorsed a cutoff of funding for the Vietnam War, 35-8, voting 44-0 against postponing a Senate floor vote on the subject until Nixon returned from his planned trip to Moscow late in the month. The caucus was now speaking with George McGovern's voice. Two Democratic war supporters, Senators Sam Ervin and Gail McGee of Wyoming, argued manfully to give the president the chance, as McGee put it, to luck out. Republican conservatives gave similar arguments. But David Broder spoke to a Republican campaign consultant who said his clients were in shock from Nixon's speech and not much enthused about crawling out on a limb with him. Broder also cited an unnamed labor politician who agreed with the president's message and counseled Democrats to be cautious in condemning it. The New York Times, for its part, now endorsed a cutoff in funding to save the president from himself. Chuck Colson spent $4,400 from his slush funds for an ad signed by 10 independent citizens, rebuking the Times for usurping the popular will. The campuses once more exploded, just as Richard Nixon knew they would. Police, sheriff's deputies, and highway patrolmen staged an assault on 5,000 violent University of Florida demonstrators. The student union in Madison was closed by trash fires and battles with club-wielding police. In College Park, Maryland, students tried to burn down an armory. The University of Minnesota suffered its worst violence in history. Spiro Agnew's limousine's rear window was smashed in Hawaii. Another hippie was shot in Albuquerque. 400 protesters were arrested sitting in at Westover Air Force Base in Massachusetts. The president of Amherst announced he would join them. Dozens more staged a lie-in in front of the White House. This is to advise you that I am planning tomorrow night to drive my Pontiac station wagon up onto the curb of Pennsylvania Avenue, Colson wrote to Haldeman, and run over all of the hippies who were lying there. Nebraska Democrats voted. McGovern barely edged out Humphrey. Wallace was winning huge crowds in the states hosting primaries May 16th. Michigan, where they liked to burn school buses, Maryland, where half the state thought like the South. The question every political analyst was now asking was whether labor boss George Meany would sit on his hands if George McGovern became the nominee. Meany was hardly friends with Dick Nixon. In fact, they were in the middle of a simmering feud. In the fall of 1971, Nixon announced Phase 2 of his wage and price controls. The details, plenty of wage controls, few price controls, enraged Meany. When the president spoke at the AFL-CIO convention on November 19th, the labor chieftain forbade the band from playing Hail to the Chief. Nixon had played to his audience's cultural grievances, reminiscing about May 1970 and Cambodia, when they had battled the hippies together. Some wrote in those days that the president stood alone. I was not alone. 150,000 workers walked down Wall Street. Then he turned to a brief discussion of Phase 2. And the workers laughed in his face. The January convention pronounced defeating him labor's primary goal for 1972. In March, Meany resigned defiantly from the White House commission advising Phase 2's wage policies, taking three labor chiefs with him. On April 20th, he testified before Congress that the price controls were a fraud. Food prices are going up, so the GNP is going up. Goody goody. But what does that do for my people? Then, along came McGovern, Meany's lone political ally, remember, in the battle against Nixon's economic policies in 1971. But McGovern was also the living symbol of reform's usurpation of labor's leverage within the Democratic Party. The timing of the Haiphong mining forced the issue. Everyone knew where George McGovern stood. Everyone knew where Nixon stood. Where, though, would George Meany stand? The answer was, with Nixon. Meany said all Americans should close ranks behind the president's brave stand to end the war in Vietnam. Meany had his deputies give blind quotes to a Washington Post reporter for a May 14th article. Leaders of organized labor remained largely hostile to McGovern. A number of labor leaders declared they were turned off by some of the young staff people surrounding Senator McGovern, describing them as elitist and zealots. Mr. Meany and other leaders were reported as virtually climbing the walls with rage after reading an interview in which Mr. McGovern was quoted as saying that just as he had conceded he had made a mistake on the 14B vote, so Mr. Meany should acknowledge that he had made a mistake in supporting the Vietnam War. Mr. McGovern, they say, is cold and preachy. Mr. McGovern, Big Labor was saying, was just not a regular guy, and that this might be enough to earn Big Labor's veto. The guy who used to get elected by shaking every wheat farmer's hand in South Dakota was spending a lot more time with fancy liberals of questionable patriotism. You could see it, some noticed, in his clothes. One of his canvassers back in Wisconsin had remarked upon it with satisfaction. At last, he knew how to tie his tie right. Gloria Steinem showed him how to tie it. You should have seen how he tied it before that.